Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on this Thursday, July 23rd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. The top headline story today, Pottawatomie County Community Foundation awards organizations through Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa. Subheadline, 5 organizations awarded more than $48,000. This is reported by Mike Brownlee. The Pottawatomie County Community Foundation has awarded more than $48,000 as part of the first grant cycle of its Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa. The foundation said it has given $48,640 to 5 local organizations: Kids Place of Glenwood, the Essex Child Center, Heartland Family Center, Centro Latino of Iowa, and Children's Square USA. The funds will support programming and projects that are focused on improving the quality of life and well-being of women and children in Southwest Iowa. Quote, as we have worked to develop the purpose and focus for the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa, it has become increasingly important and urgent to build these financial and operational resources to create tangible solutions for community-wide impact. Unquote, Janet Whitson, Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa committee member and Pottawatomie County resident, said in a release. She goes on to say, we are truly excited to be at the forefront of addressing these key issues facing women and their families here in Southwest Iowa. Here's a look at the grants and the 5 organizations that received funding according to the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation. Centro Latino of Iowa, awarded $10,000 for low to medium income Latina women living in Southwest Iowa to receive scholarship support and register for the Southwest Iowa Small Business Development and Entrepreneurship Program. Grant funding will be used to award 25 tuition scholarships to attend the 20-hour program designed to help entrepreneurs effectively start a small business. The mission of Centro Latino is to educate and empower Hispanic, Latino individuals and families in Southwest Iowa toward thriving, self-sufficient, and healthy lives. Centro Latino of Iowa is most grateful for the grant. Ramon Calzada, Centro Latino of Iowa Executive Director, said in the release, the projected goal is to increase the number of Latino-owned businesses, but most especially affordable home-based child care businesses owned by Latino women. Child Square USA awarded $10,000 to support the purchase of a van to provide transportation for teen parents and their children. Parenting teens face a multitude of barriers completing their education, with safe and reliable transportation being one of those barriers, the foundation said. Children Square USA will work with Council Bluffs Community Schools, Lewis Central Schools, and area partners to identify parenting teens in need of transportation and resources so they can remain in school and work toward a high school diploma and or acquisition of credits. Children Square USA is thrilled to receive the grant, Cheryl Clark, Vice President of Resource Development at Children Square, said in the release. She said, research shows there is a strong connection between parents' education level and their children's well-being. This grant will help create a pathway for pregnant and parenting teens to complete high school by assisting them with transportation to and from high-quality child care, she said. Helping teen parents complete high school is one step on the road toward potential post-secondary education and a more secure future for their family. Essex Child Center awarded $8,640 to support preschool tuition assistance south of the Council Bluffs metro area. The foundation noted there are families who choose to forego preschool for their children due to the added monthly expense. Studies show the importance and advantage of an early childhood education, including improved social skills, better performance in grade school, improved attention spans, and enthusiasm for lifelong learning. The grant will allow Essex Child Center to enroll an additional 16 children in the preschool program by providing tuition assistance to families. The mission of Essex Child Center is to provide a safe, nurturing, and healthy learning environment for children ages 6 weeks through 12 years of age. The Essex Child Center is truly grateful for the funding received from the Women's Fund grant, and it is hard to express in words what this means to us, said Tanya Stokes, director of the Essex Child Center. This funding will allow us to provide a free preschool program to 16 3-year-olds for the 2020-2021 school year. In Southwest Iowa, it is very rare and also extremely important to be able to offer this program at no cost to parents, especially in the midst of a pandemic. To us, this means we will be serving the children in our community to the best of our ability, with no financial strain to the families. We are so thankful for the support we have received and cannot wait to implement our tuition-free preschool program. Heartland Family Service awarded $10,000 to support child care needs and family activities for the Iowa Family Works program as individuals continue to stay home during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa Family Works promotes long-lasting recovery for women and mothers to preserve and strengthen healthy development for the women, their children, and the family unit, the release said. Funds from the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa for the Heartland Family Service Iowa Family Works program support a life-changing program which provides residential treatment for mothers and family services, said John Ginetta, president and CEO of Heartland Family Service. The funds enable us to provide child care on-site to mitigate the risk of COVID exposure for the families and employees in our program. It will also allow us to purchase items for healthy family activities. Family time is an important aspect of the program that often includes the community events, but with COVID, we had to transition to on-site activities. Kickball, yard games, backyard picnics, and chalk art are a few of the activities the families may enjoy during this time of quarantine isolation. We are so grateful. Kids Place, a child care facility in Glenwood, awarded $10,000 to support classroom repairs and renovations. The project will renovate and repurpose existing space to accommodate the community's need for child care and will ultimately increase enrollment for the facility. This funding opportunity is greatly appreciated and will allow Kids Place to make renovations to our rooms, said Heidi Lund, director of Kids Place. She says, our goal is to provide care to as many families as possible in our community and surrounding areas now and for many years to come. Our priority is to use our facility to its fullest potential and give families a safe, nurturing, quality center for their children to grow and learn in. The Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa supports 8 counties in Southwest Iowa, Cass, Fremont, Harrison, Mills, Montgomery, Page, Pottawatomie, and Shelby counties. The goal of the fund is to reach out and work closely with organizations to identify needs and design tangible solutions, the foundation said. The fund will focus on 4 areas: education initiatives for young women, increased focus on science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM initiatives, health and safety, personal finance, and equity and community engagement, accessible and affordable health care, accessible, affordable child care, and early learning programs, and access to safe and affordable transportation related to child care. Women's health, safety, and well-being. Services focused on health, safety, education, workforce equity, and well-being. Programs promoting dignity and equity for women and their children. The fund will also have funding for domestic and sexual violence programs. Aging in place. Programs and services designed to help women age gracefully in their communities, including access to quality and affordable health care, healthy foods, exercise, place-making, family resources, and volunteer services for women. Through the amazing generosity of our community, the Iowa West Foundation, the Lozier Foundation, Jerry Banks, an anonymous supporter, and several other generous investors, the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa is becoming the catalyst for durable, lasting solutions for the issues facing women and their families, Donna Dostal, president and CEO of the foundation, said in the release. We are so excited for the five organizations launching and expanding their programs because of this generosity, and look forward to measuring the impact these programs will create in our communities. The foundation said the fund will award grants to nonprofit organizations who provide services within the geographic area and can demonstrate need and ability to create change to the benefit, growth, education, and welfare of women and their families. Additional information about the fund and grant guidelines is available at the website ourpccf.org/womens-fund. On the right side column of the front page, Tim Johnson reports, Iowa Western to offer early retirement incentive. Up to 10% of Iowa Western Community College's employees could qualify for an early retirement incentive approved by the Board of Trustees Monday, a college official said. Eddie Holtz, Vice President of Finance, said, the goal behind it is it allows the college to save money to help with budgetary restraints. Up to 42 employees may qualify for the benefit, Holtz told the board. To qualify, an employee must be at least 55 years old and have at least 10 years of service at the college, he said. He said, there are 42 different employees totaling 800 years of service. We have just under 400 full-time employees. This is 10% of our full-time employees, so it's definitely a big number. In fact, this may be the largest pool ever to qualify for the incentive, which is based on a state model and has been offered periodically, Holt said. He told the board, the early retirement incentive is a plan we have offered every 3 to 5 years. It's been about 4 years since we offered it. Employees who qualify may receive a percentage of their annual salary based on years of service in a one-time allotment, plus the college's contribution toward their insurance benefits until they qualify for Medicare, Holt said. The salary portion can be paid in a lump sum or up to 3 payments divided between 2 tax years. The college will accept applications for the benefit in 2 sign-up periods in early fall and late this year, Holt said. Each individual request must be approved by the board. Employees whose applications are approved in the first group will be able to retire at the end of the year, and those cleared in the second group can retire on June 30, 2021. He said those who retire in December would help in the current budget year. Those who retire in June would just help future budget years. The college would not want to have them all retire at once if 25 to 30 employees apply, Holt said. To replace all 30 people in one swoop would be very difficult, he said. It is impossible to know how much the college would save as a result of the incentive without knowing how many employees receive it, what their salaries are, and how much the college will have to pay their replacements, Holt said. In other business, the board approved a proposal to renovate the college's welding lab at an estimated cost of $141,000. The upgrade will make room for more equipment and more students, President Dan Kinney said. Our welding program is really in demand, he said. Also on the front page at the bottom, Ernst legislation would offer tax breaks to essential workers. This is reported by James Q. Lynch of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, and it's from Cedar Rapids. Senator Joni Ernst wants to reward frontline workers who remain on the job during the coronavirus pandemic by suspending federal income taxes as well as federal payroll taxes for essential workers earning up to $50,000 a year. Legislation she introduced Tuesday would compensate essential workers who, quote, have risen to the challenge and continued in their daily jobs to care for and protect Iowans to produce and deliver food and essential goods and to uphold our state's critical infrastructure, unquote, Ernst told reporters on a conference call. Frontline workers, nurses, truck drivers, and grocery store workers, child care providers, and so many others are putting the livelihoods of their fellow Americans ahead of their own, the Iowa Republican said, and folks think they should be rewarded for their selfless service. Under Ernst Financial Relief, noting the large impact of our nation's Essential Employees Act, it's abbreviated FRNT-line, frontline, federal income taxes would be suspended for essential workers up to an annual income cap set at the highest level of pay for an enlisted person in the armed forces. Additionally, the bill would provide suspension of federal payroll taxes for essential workers who earn up to $50,000 annually. It would be retroactive to April 1st. These folks are the heroes who will help America beat this pandemic, Ernst said. It's time we pay them back. The Senate returned to Washington this week after a two-week state work period and has another scheduled in 3 weeks. That's sufficient time to develop a fourth phase of pandemic relief, Ernst said, adding, we're still in discussions, so I don't know exactly what it's going to entail. In Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, indivisible members who hope to defeat Ernst's re-election campaigns demonstrated in support of the Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act, that's acronym HEROES Act, H-E-R-O-E-S, HEROES Act. It's the House Democrats' plan for funding schools, essential services, and the postal system. GOP state leaders have no plans to take up the bill. In addition to rewarding essential workers, Ernst hopes that aid for biofuels producers who have seen their markets shrink during the pandemic will be included in the broader agriculture relief portion of the package. According to the industry, it has lost $3.4 billion in revenue since March and used 500 million fewer bushels of corn for fuel production, which typically account for 40% of the corn crop. Ernst also said she supports continued federal support for COVID-19 testing because I think that makes people feel comfortable when they know whether they have it or not, and it certainly guides what type of treatments they receive or how they go about their daily lives. She'll also be pushing for support for rural health care systems and rural clinics in the next relief package. It's important to get children back to school, but Ernst said that's a decision for states and local school boards, not the federal government. I think our superintendents are really happy that the federal government is not nosing down into their business, Ernst said. I think our superintendents, our local school boards, those parents and teachers should be making the decisions on how their children receive the education and do it in the safest possible manner. The article is accompanied by an AP photo of Senator Joni Ernst carrying, looks like a large legal-sized tablet, and wearing a blue-type blazer. And the final story on the front page is reported by Mike Brownlee, fourth Risen Sun resident dies after contracting COVID-19. A 16th Pottawatomie County resident has died after contracting COVID-19, the fourth death connected to an outbreak at Risen Sun Christian Village. The state COVID-19 website listed the death Wednesday afternoon. Matt Wyant with Pottawatomie County Public Health said it was a woman 81 years or older who lived at Risen Sun in Council Bluffs. Wyant said no new cases have been reported among residents at the long-term care facility. There have been 19 positive cases at Risen Sun and 4 deaths. On Wednesday, the state listed 14 recoveries at the facility. There were 19 new cases of COVID-19 listed in Pottawatomie County on Wednesday afternoon, putting the county's total at 945. The positive increase covered a 24-hour period from 3 p.m. Tuesday to 3 p.m. Wednesday. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, there have been 12,544 tests in the county for a positive rate of 7.5%. The site listed an additional recovery, bringing the county total to 708. Per Iowa Department of Public Health guidelines, residents with COVID-19 are considered recovered 28 days after testing positive, unless they tell local public health departments they are still symptomatic. Statewide, Iowa reported 319 new cases, bringing the total to 39,793 out of 427,908. The state positive rate remains at 9.3%. There were 6 new deaths for a total of 808. There were 282 new recoveries, putting the total at 28,607. On the opinion page, under the Our View column, retail stores should be closed on Thanksgiving. Subheadline, other stores should follow Walmart's example of being closed on Thanksgiving. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed so much about how we live. From work to school to family time to everyday life, we've all had to make adjustments in at least one aspect of living. For many people, the pandemic has accomplished one positive thing. It has reinforced and even strengthened the importance of family. On Tuesday, Walmart Incorporated announced that it will be closing its namesake stores and Sam's Clubs on Thanksgiving Day this year, saying that it wants to have its employees spend time with their families during the coronavirus pandemic. The move marks the first major indication of how COVID will affect Black Friday store shopping, for which almost a decade kicked off with big crowds on the Turkey Feast and expanded into Friday. Council Bluffs has 2 Walmart locations at 1800 North 16th Street and 3201 Manawa Center Drive, and one Sam's Club location at 3221 Manawa Center Drive. Within the last decade, possibly longer for some stores, we've seen more and more retail locations open up on the holiday that is traditionally about family time. While we know that there are some stores that have never been open on Thanksgiving, it is important to recognize the significance of Walmart's decision. In the competitive market, those stores that chose to be open on the holiday were faced with the harsh reality that staying closed meant losing business to their competitors. Therefore, employees were needed to staff the stores despite the holiday, making it so that they had to adjust their plans, if not have to cancel them outright. The pandemic has shed a new light on many of these retail workers. In stores like Walmart, which is considered an essential business, employees have been hard at work amid an international outbreak. While others are allowed to remotely work from home, they are in the stores making sure items are stocked, cleaning every surface, and ensuring that the general public has access to the things they need, such as food, medicine, clothing, and toiletries. They've worked hard. That should be acknowledged. Given safety concerns, other retail chains are rethinking their plans for the holiday shopping kickoff. Walmart's clout as the nation's largest retailer should set the example for other major retailers to follow. Macy's CEO Jeff Gennett told the Associated Press earlier this month that the department store will be pivoting its Black Friday business more toward online and will likely be going full force with holiday marketing right after Halloween. It also will be staggering events to reduce customer traffic in the stores. Walmart and others have been under increasing pressure by labor-backed groups to extend out bonus pay for frontline workers as surges in new cases have spiked in many states. In an effort to address part of that, Walmart also said Tuesday that it will be giving out another round of bonuses for workers on the front lines of the coronavirus. The company said that it will dole out $300 for full-time hourly workers and $150 for part-time hourly and temporary workers. Drivers, managers, and assistant managers in stores, clubs, distribution centers, and fulfillment centers in health and wellness will also receive a bonus. It will add up to approximately $428 million, Walmart said. The bonuses will be included in August 20 paychecks, for eligible workers employed as of July 31st. Said John Furner, president and CEO of Walmart USA, in a corporate blog post, "Our associates have been working at an incredible pace. They've solved problems, and they've set an amazing example for others. To further appreciate their incredible work, we're pleased to share another special cash bonus this summer." Many people have long derided stores opening on Thanksgiving, but at the same time, that debate hadn't stopped the lines of people seeking the special doorbuster pricing from forming outside stores. We applaud Walmart's move and hope that other retail businesses will follow suit, not only for this year, but for years to come. In-store shopping can wait until Friday. Let the retail workers have the holiday with their families. That was the Our View column on the opinion page of today's Daily Nonpareil. In the Your Views section, letters to the editor, we have five letters. The first is from Nathaniel Biederman of Council Bluffs. "Boy Scouts should offer Stop the Bleed classes. In my opinion, a Stop the Bleed class should be available for Scouts to take at Boy Scouts of America camps. The course is just as important as CPR. It can save a life. Stop the Bleed courses should be free to all Scouts and leaders. I think it should also take place in all Boy Scouts of America camps, not just summer camps. Stop the Bleed should be taught by a doctor, EMT, or paramedic. It should also be taught by a merit badge counselor that teaches first aid or emergency preparedness." That was the letter by Nathaniel Biederman of Council Bluffs. Our second letter is from Ken Lane of Council Bluffs. "Manipulated single-issue voting. Merriam-Webster Dictionary's Children's Edition definition of diversity is the condition or fact of being different. The word diversity, as currently used, intentionally creates numerous political problems instead of solving the politically inspired problems we are subjected to daily. From the beginning of children's school education, grade school through college, differences are being emphasized. Race, religion, wealth, and sexuality reign. The differences are then systematically separated. Each becomes an indivisible whole. Separated groups, as a whole, are then pandered aggressively to secure votes. Consequently, the use of diversity enhances a political ploy being used to be marketed against our voting public. Animosity takes place as a result. True diversity has been brought to fruition. The word inclusive is always included to obscure this destructive evil agenda, bringing about discord, domination of political thinking and action is the intent. Single-issue voting via manipulation often has dire, non-reversible after effects." That was a letter by Ken Lane of Council Bluffs. Our next letter is from Stephen Picorni of Urbandale, calling out Iowa senators over federal overreach in Portland. "To Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, I ask, where is your public outrage over the Trump administration's unjustified, unlawful, and unconstitutional assaults on and kidnapping of peaceful protesters in Portland? These are the actions of politically aggressive regimes of Russia, North Korea, Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. They are the tactics and authoritarian dictators have always used to suppress dissent in order to maintain political control of a country's government, as used by Pinochet in Chile, by Perón in Argentina, by Franco in Spain, by Hitler in Germany. Is the United States of America to be added to this list? You, senators, along with every lawmaker in Congress who is a true patriot, must demand that Trump cease these outrageous abuses of power. Either you are for the freedoms and liberties that the Constitution guarantees American citizens, or you oppose them. There is no opportunity for your fence sitting any longer. Are you truly for law and order, or are you actually for totalitarian oppression? Iowans deserve to know where you truly stand. That was written by Stephen Pokorny of Urbandale. The next letter is from Mindy Callison of Ames. Say no to puppy mills. Now that many families are spending more time at home, they have decided to add a new puppy or kitten to the mix. Whether they order online or head to their local puppy store, their purchases are fueling a very cruel industry. July 21 was National No Pet Store Puppies Day, and it was created to educate the public about the link between puppy mills and the pet stores and websites they sell through. Puppy and kitten mills are inhumane facilities that are often licensed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and make extreme profits due to the lack of care given to the animals. The adult dogs live in cages 6 inches larger than their bodies, they receive little to no veterinary care, and they rarely find families of their own. The puppies produced in these facilities often wind up ill or with long-term genetic diseases. Because the puppy in the window is so cute, adults often overlook doing their research before they buy and end up investing in this industry. If you are looking to add a pet to your family, look no further than your local rescue shelter. There are many puppies and purebred dogs looking for families of their own. To learn more about puppy mills and how to avoid them, visit bailingoutbenji.com or on social media. Together we can end this cruel industry once and for all. That was from Mindy Callison of Ames. And our final letter is from Jessica Bellamy, the PETA Foundation, Norfolk, Virginia. Meat is not environmentally friendly. A recent announcement from Burger King celebrating a methane reduction process in their cow farming methods may lead some consumers to erroneously believe that meat can be environmentally friendly. However, the only truly climate-friendly foods we should enjoy without reservation are vegan. Burger King's announcement glosses over the fact that cows included in this initiative are fed methane-reducing products only in the last few months of their lives, so their emissions in their early lifespan remain high. This study also fails to address many other environmental problems caused by farming cows to their flesh and milk. These include water wastage. Cows commandeer 23% of all water consumed in the U.S., deforestation and subsequent biodiversity loss, emission of other gases such as carbon and nitrous oxide, and excessive amounts of antibiotic-laden manure that is sprayed into the air and toxifies our waterways. Any food producer truly invested in curbing climate change should dump meat, milk, and eggs from their menus altogether and focus on vegan options instead. For a guide to compassionate eating in chain restaurants and a free vegan starter kit, visit PETA.org. That's PETA.org. And that was written by Jessica Bellamy, the PETA Foundation, Norfolk, Virginia. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, we turn to today's obituary. We have 7 obituaries today. The first, Raymond Calvin Maurer, 98, passed away on July 20, 2020. He was born on the family farm near Minden, Iowa, May 25, 1922, to the late Clarence L. and Margaretha Duer Maurer. After graduating from Minden High School in 1939, he worked on the family farm for 2 years, taking night school at Fay Aircraft in Omaha, Nebraska, for sheet metal training. In November of 1941, he went to the Inglewood, California, to work at the North American Aviation Plant on B-52s. He returned to Omaha to register for the draft. He worked at the Martin Bomber Plant on B-26s until he was drafted. He was inducted into the Army Air Corps in World War II on December 29, 1942, at age 20. He served for 2 years, 9 months, and 13 days. Over half of his tour was overseas as a teletype maintenance person for the 8th Air Force. He was discharged on October 11, 1945. He married Mary Betty Armstrong on July 7, 1945, while home on leave. They had been engaged for 3 years. After his discharge, Ray worked in Omaha at Jubilee as a shipping clerk for 3 years. They moved to Neola, Iowa, so that he could help his father-in-law with his seed and fertilizer business. After his father-in-law passed away, he worked for Standard Oil as a sales and delivery commission agent for 25 years. He also drove the school bus for Tri-Center Schools for 26 years, retiring from both in 1977. He was a member of Neola Presbyterian Church and Neola American Legion Post 330 for over 60 years. He was preceded in death by his wife of 74 years and his parents, sisters, Mildred, Viola, Ruth, Ethel, brothers Kenneth, Robert, and Elmer. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 23rd at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home. Family will not be present for visitation. Private family funeral service will be 1 p.m. Friday, July 24th at the Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home, with private family visitation the hour prior. The private family funeral service will be live streamed via Facebook Live on the funeral home's Facebook page. Burial at Neola Township Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Neola Presbyterian Church, Neola Fire and Rescue, or the Minden Fire and Rescue, or Neola American Legion Post 330 for Raymond Calvin Maurer. Dorothy Ann Tiarks, T-I-A-R-K-S, Dorothy Ann Tiarks, age 90, died on March 31st. She was born July 3rd, 1929, to Lee M. and Helen Charles Gittens, the youngest of three children. She was united in marriage to William M. Bill Tiarks, Sr., on December 9, 1950. To this union, one son was born, William M. Billy or Bill Tiarks, Jr. Bunny was preceded in death by her parents, brother Lee Eugene Sonny Gittens, sister-in-law Iva May, sister Helen Arlene, sister Cook, and brother-in-law Virgil C. and her husband of 59 years. Memorial service will be held at Coy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Saturday, July 25th at 11 a.m. Memorials may be directed to St. John's UCC or Muscular Dystrophy Association for Dorothy Ann Tiarks. Katie G. Jacobs, age 96, passed away July 22nd at Risen Sun. Katie was born in Council Bluffs on August 5, 1923, to the late Fritz and Sophie Winkleman Jacobs, and attended Abraham Lincoln High School. She loved her farm and kept mowing until the age of 89. She acquired shingles, which began her battle. She fought hard and battled the coronavirus, but ultimately her body and soul wore out. Katie was extremely talented in her handiwork of tatting, crocheting, and sewing. She would say, "How can I ever repay you?" We told her that's what family is for, to help one another. Katie was preceded in death by her parents, Fritz and Sophie Jacobs, sisters Martha Jacobs and Margaret Busey, and husband Walt, uncle Jaime Winkleman, and Cody Bergansel. She and her sister Martha never married and continued to live on the farm on Gifford Road. Open visitation Friday, 12 to 5 p.m. at the funeral home. Graveside service Saturday, 1 p.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery. Family and friends to meet at the funeral home for cortege to Memorial Park. The Cutler, O'Neill, Meyer, Woodring funeral home is assisting the family of Katie G. Jacobs. Harvey William Moss, age 92, passed away July 20. Harvey was born December 5th, 1927, to H. Guy and Elmo Brenneman Moss in Council Bluffs. Harvey married Bernice Miller on September 3, 1949. The couple made their home on the Moss family farm near Macedonia, Iowa. Harvey and Bernice were blessed with three sons, Kenton, Kevin, and Jason. He was preceded in death by his parents, son Kevin, wife Bernice, siblings Vernon Moss, Celia Wilhelm, and James Moss. Visitation for Harvey William Moss will be Friday, July 24th at Coy Kilnowski Funeral Home. Funeral services Saturday, July 25th, 11 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church, Trainer, Iowa. Burial will be at the Macedonia Cemetery. The family requests masks to be worn by those in attendance. Memorials can be directed to Macedonia Volunteer Fire Department or St. Paul Lutheran Church on behalf of Harvey William Moss. Carl F. Ulmer, 84, of Council Bluffs, passed away July 21 at CHI Mercy Hospital. Carl was born February 10, 1936, in Stuart, Florida, to the late Glenn F. and Luddy Callahan Ulmer. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force from 1954 to 1975, two tours in Vietnam. Carl married Ann Pavich on June 28, 1958. They were blessed with four children. After his honorable discharge from the military, Carl worked for the United States Postal Service for 18 years, retiring in 2002. Carl was a member of Corpus Christi Holy Family Parish. In addition to his parents, Carl was preceded in death by his wife, Ann Ulmer, in 2003, and his brother, Robert Ulmer. Memorial Mass, Saturday, 10 a.m. at Corpus Christi Holy Family Church in Enormit in St. Joseph Cemetery, with military rites tendered by Canesville Honor Guard. A lunch will follow at the Holy Family Parish Hall. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the Mass at the church. The family will direct memorials. The Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home is handling arrangements for Carl F. Ulmer. Sheridan L. Sonny Thompson III, age 63, of Honey Creek, Iowa, passed away January 12th. Celebration of life service Saturday, July 25th, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Aeroplane Inn in Honey Creek. Military honors will be tendered by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home, handling arrangements for Sheridan L. Sonny Thompson III. Gerald B. Jerry Shaw, 43, of Council Bluffs, passed away July 19 at Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Born April 27, 1977, in Omaha, Nebraska, to Connie Freeze Shaw and Reuben Adkins. Jerry was preceded in death by his mother, Connie Freeze, grandfather, Ernest Freeze, Sr. Visitation with family Friday from 5 to 7 p.m., funeral service Saturday, 10 a.m., all at Maher Funeral Home, the burial Cedar Lawn Cemetery. The family will direct memorials for Gerald B. Jerry Shaw. Now we turn to the sports page for updates on the baseball-softball tournaments. Abraham Lincoln falls to Ankeny in sub-state final. This is reported by Derek Norin. Abraham Lincoln's postseason run ended Wednesday as Ankeny punched its ticket to the state tournament with a 5-0 victory in the Class 4A Substate A title game. After wins over Lewis Central and Des Moines North, Abraham Lincoln was looking for one more win to go to state for the first time since 1980. Iowa Football 2021 wide receiver commit Brody Brecht earned the win on the mound for Ankeny, which advances to the state tournament for the second consecutive year and 14th time in program history. Ankeny plated three in the first inning and a run apiece in the second and fourth, and kept Abraham Lincoln off the board despite threats to score. This year's 4A 8 sub-state tourney had a different look after what would have been the number one and number two seeds, Dowling Catholic and Thomas Jefferson, both had their seasons end prematurely due to the positive COVID-19 test. The official state pairings had not yet been posted by press time, but it will be released by the Iowa High School Athletic Association. The 4A quarterfinals are scheduled to begin on Wednesday at Principal Park in Des Moines. Patrick Donahue reports another story. Harlan falls in 3A sub-state finals. This is from Grimes. An eight-run sixth inning helped Dallas center Grimes earn a 12-2 six-inning victory Wednesday over Harlan in the Class 3A sub-state 8 finals. Isaiah Ehrenholz drove in two runs for the Cyclones in the losing effort. Harlan closes its season at 15-4, while Dallas center Grimes advances to next week's state tournament in Des Moines. Dallas center Grimes's record currently is now 17-3. And we have a prep football story. Lewis Central tight end Thomas Fidone schedules first official visit to LSU. This is reported by Mike Souter of the Omaha World Herald. Lewis Central senior Thomas Fidone has his first official visit planned. The 6'4", 220-pound tight end has scheduled a trip to LSU for September 12th. "Right now, that is the only one I have planned," Fidone said. "I'm kind of just seeing if the LSU one gets canceled before scheduling any more. I don't have another four, but probably Michigan, possibly Georgia, because I'm really close to their tight end coach, Coach Todd Harley, and I'm thinking about visiting Alabama." Fidone, a national recruit, is the number one ranked tight end in the 2021 class, according to 24/7 Sports, and a number three tight end, according to Rivals. On March 16, Fidone named a top six that included Nebraska, LSU, Notre Dame, Iowa, Michigan, and Penn State. But that hasn't stopped others from recruiting him. "Some of those schools don't even recruit me anymore," he said. LSU and Nebraska are two that have continued to recruit Fidone and the two schools he talks to the most. He said, "LSU FaceTimes me every day. Nebraska is probably second most." Fidone and his family grew up rooting for Nebraska University, so much so he wouldn't let the emotions get to him after a loss. "We grew up Nebraska fans. We used to cry when they lost," he said. "It totally changed once I started getting offers. I realized I needed to not be a fan of just one school." Last week, Fidone got the opportunity to catch passes from an NFL quarterback when former Creighton Prep and current Los Angeles Chargers quarterback Easton Stick was in Omaha. "He didn't know who I was, and we talked on the field during the workout. He said just watching me on the field that he was guessing I had a lot of college options." Fidone said of Stick, "That was really cool to hear from an NFL quarterback." The article is accompanied by a picture of a senior Thomas Fidone of Lewis Central wearing a football helmet and a sleeveless shirt with "Soldier" written across the front. He's wearing gloves, and he is a 6'4", 220-pound tight end, and he scheduled his trip to LSU for September 12th. Then we go back to page 2. Council Bluffs man sentenced on meth charges for a 2019 traffic stop. This is reported by Mike Brownlee. A Council Bluffs man has been sentenced to 10 years in prison on drug charges. Matthew Carson, 37, was sentenced by U.S. District Court Chief Judge John A. Jarvie for possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine and carrying a firearm during a drug trafficking crime, according to a release from the Office of U.S. Attorney Mark Crickbaum. The charges and convictions stem from two traffic stops of Carson by Council Bluffs police officers in 2019. During the two stops, officers found 20 and 24 grams of meth, respectively, and with a loaded gun during the second stop. This investigation was conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department and prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. And on the page 2 Face of the Day column, Hannah Myers is a familiar face to many of the 100 block of West Broadway. Myers, 20, is a Council Bluffs native who grew up going to school in the Lewis Central Community School District. She graduated from Lewis Central High School in 2018, and she's been attending Iowa Western Community College ever since, studying in the school's dental hygiene program. She said she wanted to pursue a career that allowed her to help take care of people, and she thought working in the oral health field would be a great way to give back to people in her community. She expects to graduate next May. Myers has been working at Varley's for the past 5 years or so. She started as a food runner in high school and graduated to the server position when she turned 18. She said it's been a blast being part of the Varley's family, noting great staff, customers, and how it is a staple in the Council Bluffs community. She said, "I love the atmosphere here. I love all the regulars. I've been working here for so long, but I take breaks when I'm in school. And when I come back during my breaks, it's exciting to see everyone again." Myers said she also loves the food at Varley's. "I never get tired of eating here," she said with a laugh. Myers said it's interesting working on the 100 block, being a part of a network of so many other restaurants, watering holes, and other businesses. She said staff members from across the block are all friendly, and it's nice knowing so many familiar faces. She said, "You know, in Council Bluffs, I feel we all have a real sense of community. All the bars, we help each other out, and we all know who works where, and we all hang out together. It's just a really nice place to be." Myers keeps plenty busy between work and school, but when she has free time, she said she loves spending time with her younger sisters, who are both in the LC school system. Her sister, Carly, will be starting middle school in the fall, and her older sister, Sophie, will be a high school senior. Myers said she is happy to see them both on their way to a bright future. The article is accompanied by a smiling picture of the face of the day, Hannah Myers, and she's wearing the trademark Varley's shirt that she wears when she is working. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for this Thursday, July 23rd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.